You're listening to Sex and Spirituality, a part of the teaching ministry of First Baptist Church in downtown Tulsa. We exist to glorify God in all we do.
So this is the Sex and Spirituality class. Feel free to run for the door if that's not what you thought it was. I try to put this up early so people know what they're signing up for. So we're spending 14 weeks talking about reclaiming the beautiful vision for sexuality, gender, and marriage from the Bible. And so the first week we talked about how we have a tendency to get our moral values from stories, right? And again, that may be a very new concept for you because we don't live in a culture that is steeped in what we would call mythology or stories. In terms of how we learn about reality. However, we still just kind of get our and justify our moral inclinations mainly from stories. And so we talked about that the first week, the power of narratives and stories. And God knows this, right? The Bible is completely architected towards this. And that's why it really is timeless in how it talks about values, because it embeds them in these narratives that make so much sense to us, regardless of our time or culture or education level. And then last week we began talking about what story, and of course when I say story, I mean the thousands and thousands of stories that make up our culture, right? In media and movies and books, but also in people's lives. What can we say about the story of sexuality in our contemporary time? Because that's what's presenting a rival vision, okay? A rival vision to biblical sexuality. And so we have to understand that. And so if you remember from last week when we're looking at this, which is how did we get here, the main thing I want you to be thinking about is how can this build empathy for me with someone who is living maybe a lifestyle. Oh, Ezra, I know you hear me, buddy. how can I build up empathy for those that are living lifestyles that I don't understand or approve of, because I understand that they're getting their moral inclinations from the stories of our culture. And so hopefully that'll make you more empathetic to see, oh yeah, you know, they're getting those values because of the movies they watch and the books that they read and the stories of sexuality that are all around them. And then also to really take a very hard critical look at yourself and say, where have these aspects of the story of our culture gotten into the way I think about sexuality? It's very important to take that step instead of just assume, I have a biblical view of sexuality. And instead to say, where has this gotten into my DNA, the way I think about my own spouse, or the way I think about telling my children about sexuality? Where have these things gotten into me? And then the third thing, right, is to be able to engage on these issues intelligently, okay? Because when we talk to somebody outside the church, if we present the do's and don'ts of the Bible in terms of sexuality outside of this narrative, it has almost no power, right, to convince them of anything. And we saw last week, one of the key aspects of the culture's narrative on sexuality is that the Christian view, and really most religious views, are oppressive and outdated. And so if that narrative is what's at work, it's very easy for them to filter the do's and don'ts and to say, well, you know, maybe that works for you, but you're living in the past, you know, or something. And so we need to be able to engage them on, well, this is what they believe sexuality is about. We need to understand that in order to have a conversation with them. So those are the three kind of goals. So review from last week, and actually before we review from last week, let me pray for us, and then we'll kind of remember the five aspects we saw last week and see five more today. So Father, we ask you to help us today as we seek to better understand how the culture is presenting a rival vision to the model and the design that you have for sexuality and gender and marriage, and help us to be better equipped to think about these things, to engage in our own families, in the lives of others. Grow in us a heart of empathy for those who are deceived about sexuality and about where to find meaning and the good life. And then also just root out any of these aspects that have become the way we process life and the way we evaluate what would be a healthy vision of sexuality. And so do that today as we work through this this material. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, so last week, the first five values, I'm going to go through these quickly because we went through them in detail last week. But first, almost without reservation, human sexuality is celebrated and affirmed as inherently good in our culture. Okay, that's probably not surprising to you. We've been on a momentum towards that for at least four decades now, to affirming sexuality in all of its variety as inherently good. However, not sacred. In other words, it doesn't have religious connotations. And your religion doesn't affect that. Even morals don't affect that. So one of the examples I gave last time is that somebody's moral character is not usually evaluated by their sexual practice anymore. Now, we do still do that in politics sometimes, but that's more because of the power of those positions, not because of our views on sexuality. So if I meet a guy and he, whether he's a faithful husband and been married for 25 years, or he's been living together with somebody for 25 years, that doesn't affect my evaluation of him as a person, right, moral character-wise. That's just his own choice, right? That's becoming more and more the case. This celebration represents a strong reaction against the perceived narrowness and repression of religious understandings of sex and marriage. So it's not just arbitrarily a celebration. It's celebrating it particularly against the backdrop of what's thought of as repressive and narrow that we're trying to come out of, or that culture sees us as trying to come out of. Sexual ethics are formed with a very high priority on individual human rights over pursuing a common good. So for the most part, there's no sense of responsibility in the culture being put on people towards your sexual behavior affects other people, even children that might be produced. You don't have to think about that, right? That's not your responsibility. Instead, it's about your own self-expression of who you are. And you should do what is right for you, right? And so massive emphasis on allowing people the right to pursue sexuality however that they want to, with very little emphasis on common good. Let me just give you one example of this because I can't help it. Pornography. How crazy is it that you have to be 18 years old to buy a pack of cigarettes? You have to be 21 years old to buy an alcoholic beverage. And the average exposure to hardcore pornography is 9 to 11 in this country because we have no restrictions on the internet at all. We don't even create, I mean, there was a petition, I think it was about a decade ago when it first started, to create a domain, .xxx, and require pornographic content to go to that domain so that it was very easily filterable, right? Anything that has .xxx in the domain, very easy to take out for software, for a service provider, never got any traction. And yet we know this destroys children, right? This kind of exposure. And yet, obviously that's a common good, right? That'd be a common good to at least restrict it from non-adults, at least, right? And yet we won't even make that easy. Matter of fact, if you're a parent and you're trying to keep explicit content out of your home, you'll figure out how hard it actually is to do that, right? It's incredibly difficult to even try to do that. So that's just one example of, like, we can't get together as a society and for the common good protect children from that, you know, especially, you know, below the ages of 18 where they can't even decide if they want to smoke or not, and yet they can decide to look at anything and everything. And so we're not doing anything to promote the common good in that field. So that just shows you the values, and yet how much this discussion is talked about individual rights to expression of my sexuality, my gender identity, those kinds of things. How much political effort is being spent there? Tons, right? And no effort in promoting the common good. So it just shows you how out of balance it is. The primary, if not exclusive, goal of sexual relationships is individual fulfillment and personal happiness. And I said this is one of the ones that's gotten into the church more than some of the others. And what I mean by that is imagine a Christian couple of friends or a non-Christian couple of friends, and one of them is not happy in their marriage, I could easily see a Christian or a non-Christian saying to them, well, if you're not happy, you owe it to yourself, right, to find happiness, to find something better than that. And, you know, this relationship isn't good for you. And what is that? It's I've put a primary purpose for romantic sexual relationships as personal fulfillment. And of course, in the Bible, that is icing on the cake. That has nothing to do with what it's for at all. There's three main purposes we'll look at, but this isn't one of them. So yes, but this is the only purpose really that's ever promoted, is you should be in a romantic or sexual relationship as long as it's fulfilling to you. And the second that the downs overweigh the ups, you should probably do something better for yourself, right? Okay, and then number five from last week, sex is highly privatized in modern society as long as its two moral rules are followed. We're going to talk about the two moral rules that remain in our culture for sexuality. But as long as those rules are being followed, then it's my body, my business, right? It's a highly privatized thing. And most of us don't understand how unusual that is culturally, because it was always understood that sexuality affects community. It affects children, it affects families, it affects parents, it affects everybody, right? And so sexual relationships are communal in their impact, and so they should be communal in their exposure to oversight. And yet, if you're a 14-year-old girl and you get pregnant, the school doesn't even notify your parents, right? Whereas if you need aspirin, they have to notify you first. Why? Because this is highly privatized, right? This is about you. This is your life. And so even with children, that's become the case. Okay, so those are the five we talked about last week. We're going to cover five more now, key aspects of the narrative in our culture. And then what I'm going to do at the end is I'm going to look at four reasons why so many Christians are jumping ship to the cultural story. Because it's very, very important that we understand, what is it that's pulling us away from a biblical vision of sexuality to start to adopt either some or all of these aspects of sexuality? It's very important you understand what's doing that for Christians. Okay, so number six, each sexual relationship is an end in itself, with no higher purpose existing outside of the relationship, establishing meaning beyond the participants. So what do I mean by that? I mean, family, right, is less and less involved, for example, in romantic relationships. I think I mentioned last week how when Yale students would come to me for advice when they wanted to pursue a dating relationship, one of the first things I would usually advise the guys to do is contact the parents of the girl, not as some sort of formal, you know, kind of courting thing, but just to say, I'm so-and-so, she's agreed to go out with me, and I'm committing to you to be accountable because, you guys have invested your entire life in taking care of her, and if you hear anything from her, I want you to know you can contact me. If you have questions about my behavior or how I'm treating her, I'm committing to you to honor her in this relationship, and just do that, right? Well, what does that do? Well, it invites, right, more meaning into the relationship, that this relationship is about her not just having a good time, but her actually hopefully finding family. And so from the outset, family should be somewhat involved. Now, there's no model for this given in the Bible. There's no rules about how family should be involved. But throughout time, family has been deeply involved, now, sometimes in ways that are too controlling for children, right? I'm not saying we should go to arranged marriages or marriages of convenience to try to maximize wealth of households or things that have been done in the past, but this is a decision that affects entire families, and so families should be involved. In other words, the purpose of this is more than just we're looking to find a good time or we're looking to find fulfillment in the moment. Of course, the other obvious meaning outside of those two is children, right? And our culture has been at war for at least five decades trying to detach procreation from sexuality in many, many ways, trying to detach those decisions, right? And so it is incredibly normal to hear a Christian or a non-Christian say, well, I think I'm ready. I think I want to be married, but I'm not sure yet if I want to have kids. It's like, what? It's like that. That's one of the central purposes of marriage, is children. Now, why would they even think that instead of thinking, I want to have a family or I don't? Because those two decisions have been divorced from each other, right? well, I want to have a romantic relationship, and I want to go through my life with somebody, and I want to have a sexually fulfilling relationship. But what do I think about kids? In other words, our culture has successfully divorced those two through family, being able to family plan, being able to try to prevent pregnancy, having abortion, right? All of these options to try to say you can pursue sexuality and it doesn't have to involve children. And yet that defies basic biology. It defies, obviously, thousands of years of history that these are intimately related. And so the average person that you talk to today that starts a sexual relationship, ask them this question. If they entered into a sexual relationship or they decided to live together. So do you want to have kids together? Whoa. So what does that have to do with anything? Well, that's what sexuality is about. Why would you do that? And you haven't even talked about it or thought about it. If this is this person I want to parent with. Because this culture has successfully divorced those two, right? Not to mention the community impacts, right? So churches should be involved. Communities should be involved. Because this is a family unit that's forming that is a basic kind of building block of society, church, all of these other things. So there is no kind of end outside of that. So each relationship instead is viewed as we're free to do what we want, and this is only about us. And as soon as one of us doesn't want to be here, then it can dissolve and no harm done, right? That's kind of how everything is viewed. Okay, number 7. The only two moral rules that are considered binding on all people in sexual relationships today are consent, okay? Both people have to be consenting, and tolerance. In other words, now, what do I mean by moral rules? What I mean is that if you break the consent rule or you're intolerant towards the sexual practices of others, that's what makes you evil, right? That's what makes you immoral. Yes?
I thought about this last week, too. The question, and I think it applies to all of these topics we're discussing, but there's been a shift in the definition of the word tolerance. It seems to me, when I first learned the word, it was be able to tolerate, but not to accept or embrace.
Right. So the word tolerance can have a range of meanings in terms of what do I think tolerance looks like? And we've become this isn't just in this area or other areas. We've become a positive affirming society, which means that what's required for you to be tolerant is not just for you to say, well, I disagree with that. And this comes from lots of things, but it mainly comes through the history of the other types of rights arguments that we've been in as a country. So when it came to civil rights and end of slavery, what happened? Well, slavery ended, and now everybody had to tolerate that, whether they agreed with it or not, right? They had to tolerate that African Americans were free, but a bunch of them didn't affirm it, right? And so for another 100 years, what you saw was, and of course some of it was obviously illegal, immoral behavior, but a lot of it was just intolerant, right? I don't want a society. So segregation is a good example of that. It's like you're free, but only if we remain separate. Well, there's no laws in the books to affirm that, right? And so they have to make up a bunch of laws to do that. And so after that, we went through the same thing with gender issues, right? Women get the right to vote. Women get all of these other rights. And yet there's still this stigma of not affirming women in these places and even ridiculing them or oppressing them. So by the time we come to sexual ethics, even though this is a very different issue than gender or race, that's the only way we're used to promoting tolerance, is you have to change your whole mindset and see this as good instead of just see this as, well, that's your point of view. And so the word tolerance does mean just tolerate, but we've, for a long time, substituted what we're looking for in a tolerant person is somebody that affirms. And so it's been a long time coming. But where it's broken down in this is in the sexual revolution. So in other revolutions, they weren't revolutions about behavior or inclinations. They were resolutions about denying human dignity to citizens, right? equal human dignity to citizens, and picking and choosing and saying some rights are for some citizens and some rights are not. Now the LGBT revolution that's been happening has been very successful in equating those two, in saying this is exactly the same thing, right? But it's not exactly the same thing, right? This is not the same. Now, are there some genetic inclinations that are genetic causes that contribute to sexual preference or gender dysphoria? Probably. But it's not exactly the same thing as race. And it's not the same things in terms of the rights they were arguing for. So, for example, the right to marry is not the same as what we were talking about before, because that requires changing what marriage is. We've had this discussion. So they've successfully kind of convinced the masses that for you to be non-affirming of other sexual lifestyles is the same as being racist. And they've done that through basically through an incredibly organized strategy. There's books written on it, at how incredibly successful they've been at making these connections, right? At connecting the way our country used to think about interracial marriage to the way we think about gay marriage, for example. And when somebody stands up and says, these aren't exactly the same things, then they're usually immediately regulated because the story is so strong. And we'll talk about kind of what does that. But being an affirming person is what's required when the culture moves morally. So if the culture moves to think it's immoral to be this way, then they start to require you to conform. And that's what's happened with LGBT, is that the underlying culture, at least, has moved to it's a moral category to be affirming, right? And if you're not affirming, you're immoral, or you're oppressive to people who are not like you. So that's been a major shift. However, it's still under the word tolerance, and it still means that you have an attitude that says, my views on sexuality have no bearing on you, right? They have no bearing on you. So anytime, so as much as Christians are vilified in terms of sometimes for their views on sexuality, or any religious person for that matter, as long as I just used it to guide my own ethical decisions, we probably wouldn't have a problem. But it's when that ever becomes part of my identity in the society or in the culture, right? It's when I start operating my business under those principles or those kinds of things that now the culture is like, no, we're not allowing you to do that because that's immoral now. And that's why it's interesting that tolerance has become one of the moral rules, which means if you don't do this, you're considered evil. So somebody can be a dominatrix, and that somebody else can be sleeping with thousands of people. No morality is assigned by the culture to that, right? Now, we may, individually, but no, the culture is, well, that's their business. However, the second you say that person's, the way they're practicing sexuality is wrong, you're immoral, right? Or if there's not consent, which is, the Me Too movement is a great example of this, right? Consent is the only kind of rule that has remained, that both people have to be consenting. Now, why? Based on the principles we've covered so far, why has consent strengthened? Not like every other value that has weakened or went away. Consent has strengthened over time as more central of a value. Why has that happened? Have you ever thought of that? Why do we care so much about consent today?
It justifies
us?
No.
Yeah? Okay. Well, go back to number 3. Incredibly high priority on individual human rights and not on the common good. So, if anybody's rights are being infringed upon, well, then we go back to something even higher. It's a higher court of appeal. Somebody did something to somebody that they didn't want to happen. That's even worse, right, than anything else. And so as individual human rights have become the dominant way to define morality, then consent has become a bigger and bigger deal. Now, what's the problem with consent as a governing rule for sexual ethics? relationships are incredibly messy, right? So this is the problem. If you were to sit through the 4 hours of mandatory sexual education at the average college campus, and they have students get up there and go through scenarios. They talk about, okay, you're at a party and this girl looks intoxicated and she's interested in you. Every one of those scenarios is only about one thing. In that particular scenario, did she say yes or did she not? Right? Now, there's two big reasons to this. One is not understanding where the person said yes or not is never the problem. In other words, when there is sexual misconduct, or it's not because whoever was aggressive or was the aggressor in that situation. I couldn't really tell what was going on, right? I couldn't tell that she wasn't as into it as I was, or vice versa, right? That's never, in other words, these scenarios are false realities. It's not that they were really working hard to try to figure out what's in the best interest of this other person. No, it's the exact opposite, right? I'm trying every way I can to use this person, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's the right, they can't say anything wrong with that, as long as that person doesn't say no. So what lots of college campuses have been doing in the last 10 years is moving from a consent model of no means no, right, which is the one we've heard probably for a long time, to a consent model of yes means yes. What does that mean? Is that you have to actually say, you have to ask what you would like to do, and the other person has to say yes in order for you to know it's okay. Now, put that into a dating relationship. Could I please kiss you for 5 more minutes? Yes, you may. Like, who is ever going to do those things, right? In other words,
there's actually a consent app now.
Is it a consent app?
You can go to consent app, fill out the app, both of you sign it, and it's a contractual agreement to consent.
It's basically a momentary marriage, right?
Yeah, it's a momentary marriage consent app.
Yeah, yeah.
It exists.
So it's a momentary I do ceremony that you can do on your cell phones. But the point of this is that this is the only rule, this is the only trump card we have to play. People are being incredibly deeply wounded sexually all the time. Women are marching, screaming out that we all have these wounds we're carrying deeply, and they're trying in the narrative of our culture to find out why do I feel so victimized? Because at some point, some guy didn't clearly get my consent. That must have happened because that's the only thing I can cling to in terms of moral behavior. And so now what's happening in the Me Too movement is people are writing these massive stories of the things that happened to them. And the problem is in the story, they give consent. And so culture's like, that guy was a jerk. And he was very aggressive. But he asked, and she said yes. Or she said, not that, but this. So we can't do anything because we don't have any rules for that. Instead of saying, as a culture, we do not use each other sexually, period. But our whole culture denies that. Of course we do. That's what pornography is. That's what half of our culture is built on. You know, that's what our marketing campaigns for hamburgers is built on. It's all built on using people, right? So we can't go back to anything higher than that because we've already made a mockery of that with our lack of rules, right? So we're in a real kind of crisis right now, and they're trying to figure out a new way forward. And the problem is they're still doing this under, let me protect every individual to do exactly what they want. Now we as Christians, and we'll talk about this when we get the narrative, we know that's the problem. if you as a culture in any area of ethics are saying what our aim is to get it to be as free as possible for you to do anything you want in that area, well, that's the best way to kill all of us, right? It's horrible. In other words, we all need accountability, we need rules, we need societal pressure to behave properly, in addition to the Holy Spirit and everything that God provides. You know, we need that to keep things in check. Matter of fact, government authority, that's what the Bible says it's for. It's to put societal norms on people to refrain evil. And so they're never going to give up that virtue, I don't think, of the individual can freely choose whatever they want. And so without changing that, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. But the consent model doesn't work. And there's some great pieces on this. I think it was in First Things not too long ago that a guy wrote a piece on this, reflecting on a couple of the last issues that came on up in the Me Too movement. It's just saying the consent model is dead. It just does not work. And college campuses are just getting worse and worse and worse as a date rape culture and as a culture where people are getting suicidal and depressed because of the sexual culture. So it's just getting worse and worse. But that's really still where we are, okay? So, and you probably know this, right? That if there's a guy at your office who schemes all the women, right, and has slept with half the office, he's not going to get into trouble. But if there's a guy who grabbed a girl and she said no, he's going to get fired, right? Now, I'm not saying he shouldn't be fired. I'm not speaking that consent is not a good rule in a panoply of a better vision of sexuality. But as a sole rule, it just seems weird, right? How come this guy has like destroyed lives at this among the people that work here, and this guy had one moment of being an idiot, and he's fired. You know, his career's over, right? Because this is the only rule we got. That's the answer to that. Okay. All right.
We're gonna have to change our whole society because sexy, seductive women are used to sell everything from a nice, juicy steak to a new car. Now I'm waiting until they put half naked men up there. I mean, really, think about it. They're reacting to what they've seen their whole
life. Right, and that goes back to that first principle, that sexuality, your body, body positivity, that's always inherently good. There's no negative of that. So anything like modesty or chastity, that's silly, right? That's silly. You're not affirming a natural part of being a human being. Okay, now here's an interesting one, and yet it's still true. The most dominant pattern of sexual practice today among people is still serial monogamy. Okay, now it's not just monogamy, it's serial monogamy, and we'll talk about that. But despite the liberalism that we have sexually in terms of, you know, the society won't judge you for how you're practicing your sexuality, so in theory, that could support any kind of lifestyle, right? The vast majority of people still pick faithful monogamy as the ideal, okay? In other words, getting in a relationship with one person and expecting fidelity in that relationship. In other words, getting outraged if they're unfaithful and things like that. That's still the pattern of behavior. And we'll talk about that once we get to the, I think it's the section on redeeming romance and sexual desire. When we get to that, we'll talk about why people still want that in the culture that offers them everything. Why, for the most part, people are still drawn to serial monogamy. But yeah, we'll get to that. But what's changed dramatically is monogamy now is no longer practiced mainly within the consent of marriage, though marriage still remains a goal for most people. It's kind of interesting. And this is one of the reasons, you know, the marriage discussion, expanding marriage to include, you know, same-sex couples was such a big deal, because it still remains a primary desire, because there's still parts of marriage that are romanticized, right? Movies still celebrate weddings and still celebrate that moment of engagement, right? Matter of fact, we've gotten even ludicrously over the top celebrating those. You know, you'll have these engagement videos with hundreds of people involved. And so, again, that's because there's some aspects of marriage that celebrate love and celebrate the individual, right, as somebody worthy of love, that our individualistic culture still is like, oh, I like that, right? I like the day full of flowers and whatever, and I like the honeymoon, and I like all of that. So marriage is still an ideal for a lot of people, and a faithful relationship with one person is still an ideal, despite the fact that, you know, the kind of Pandora's box of options has been opened. But monogamy is no longer tied, this is very important, to expectations of permanence, okay? So for the average person, getting into a long-term relationship doesn't carry the baggage of, well, we're going to be together forever. And so that's why prenuptial agreements are a lot more ubiquitous. That's why decisions to have children, even if people, a couple have been together for 7 or 10 years, is a separate decision, because that ties us in for a while, right? And we didn't sign up permanently, so are you sure we want to do that? It's kind of an interesting thing, but that's typical in couples today, for them to have a children discussion that's kind of separate from deciding to be in a faithful monogamous relationship. And then marriage, right? Marriage does represent permanence, so a lot of people delay or don't even seek it because of that baggage, the permanence baggage, because it's just not part of their ideal anymore, the permanence part of marriage. And so the baggage of getting out of it, right, at some point, if it's not working, is enough to keep some people from doing it and just living together. But that doesn't mean they're not in a faithful relationship and expect fidelity from each other. So the stress is not on lifetime sexual partnership, but fulfillment from a particular relationship as long as it lasts. Okay? So we're going to change as people. If there's ever a point where you're not good for me or I'm not good for you, well, then I'm not going to ruin your life. We'll part ways, right? Whether we're married or not. Maybe we're married because we wanted a wedding, we wanted the honeymoon, we wanted that societal kind of status, but we still didn't attach the permanent expectation. Now, this may be something that comes up after you're married. In other words, this maybe you always thought, I'm committed to permanence, but then you get married. And what changes from dating engagement to marriage? Personal happiness. So it just does. I'm sorry. So in marriage, for most people, within the first year, there's a pretty steep fall off of personal happiness, and new fears can come out. It all depends on you, your personality, what you go through as a couple. But for many couples, in that first year, lots of this comes in. And so if permanence wasn't actually an ideal, it was just kind of a pipe dream of your romanticism, right? What comes up in that first, well, this isn't working. And the narrative of non-permanence that's in the culture starts to make perfect sense to you out of nowhere. Why? That's never been in the Bible. That's probably never been in how you were taught ethics, especially if you grew up in a Christian household, because it's ubiquitous in the culture, right? As all the stories that I've heard is that, yeah, some marriages don't work out. And so immediately you start to think, well, maybe I was in love and all these other stuff, but this is not good for me anymore, right? And it's only a commitment to that ideal that would keep you in that scenario, and that's a lot of times when people realize, I don't actually have an ideal of permanence. I only had an ideal of weddings and those kinds of things. Okay. Questions so far? Okay, so the last two take some explanation, but they're very important. Because they seem to be contradictory, but in some ways, sex is seen as not a big deal, okay? So sexual relationships are now I'm going to give you a few different ways this has changed, especially among young people. Sexual relationships are now seen as secondary in terms of personal priorities. This is, man, I wish you could just go to a college campus and see this. How many of you, when you went to college, everybody was like, I wonder who I'm going to end up with, right? And you know, you were thinking about who I was going to date. And I'm not talking about just being only in college to get married. I mean, some people do that. But you know what I mean? You're now on your own. You're now kind of an adult. And you're thinking, where is my spouse somewhere out there, right? And now people are like, that is stupid to do that. Don't do that, right? Even in their mid-20s, they're that way. Because they have other priorities of life, education, their career, their lifestyle preference, which just means maybe they have a lot of experiences they want. They want to travel. They want to do certain things. They want to, you know, learn how to play the cello, whatever it is. They have things that they want to do, and they're like, I'm not even going to think about pursuing marriage until I accomplish my goals. Well, that's a change. That's a shift in culture from normal adulthood in most societies, where when you became at a place where you could consider how I'm going to earn a living and you began to plant yourself as a person that could sustain himself outside the household, then you started immediately to think, well, who, what kind of person would I want to marry? And you know, looking for that. So dating relationships are becoming less and less and less, especially on college campuses. But even later, and you can even see it in the way, internet dating was big when I was single, but it was all about finding a mate, at least the people I knew. Maybe it wasn't for everybody. And when I think of the dating apps they use now, like Tinder is a good example. So Tinder is an app that just shows you photos of people. You don't read, you don't find out what religion is. You just see their face and you feel like, pretty, not pretty, pretty, not pretty. You know, that's basically what you do. Or I'd go out with him, I wouldn't go out with her, or that guy. You go out with him, I wouldn't go out with that guy. You just swipe, that's all he is. That's all the time I'm giving that decision. And then anybody that you said I would go out with that person has the freedom to contact you to try to go out. Well, how is that so much different than eHarmony and all of these other things that came about when I was, well, those were structured so you could get to know from the profile who this person is to see if maybe we're a good match for each other. And it wasn't just eHarmony, which has some Christian roots. It was most of them that way. You know, what are my likes? What are my dislikes? You know, anything, you know. And so it was that way. Matter of fact, Facebook, if you watch the story of Facebook, that's originally what, you know, he thought it would be for, mainly used for, is people looking at people and trying to figure out if they want to pursue them. But now that's just like, why? Because this is a low priority to me right now, but I still want to date people, right? I still want to have romantic encounters with people, but I'm not really pursuing a relationship. So sexual relationships are not a big deal in terms of priorities. And with some exceptions, most in modern culture would consider sexual practice to be amoral, which means everybody, you know, it seems ubiquitous that everybody looks at porn, everybody has premarital sex. Did you guys know the statistics? It's 95%, 95, 96% is what the surveys say, have sex before marriage. It's so ubiquitous that we don't assign moral categories to it, right? And if we do, it's our own little set, right? Like we need to go on 6 dates, or, you know, it's not a global standard. It's more, I've done enough to invest in this relationship, and now we're ready, whatever that feels like to the person. And so it's just kind of amoral. We don't evaluate the goodness or character of people according to their sexual practices anymore, and so it's not really thought of in moral categories as much. Sex is now seen as separate or fragmented from the rest of life. This is another really important thing. And of course, pornography has really fueled this, having no bearing on other areas such as work or civil duty or friendships or religious practices. And even though our politicians get in trouble for this all the time, right, whenever it's found out that they had illicit sexual activity going on behind the scenes, what's the first thing that usually comes up from their supporters, as long as it was consensual? Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with who they are as president. Yes, it does. It has a lot to do with it, right? Because it speaks to their moral fiber. It speaks to and it speaks to their fidelity to a spouse, which is massively important, their fidelity overall. I mean, there'd have to be a lot of scarring of my conscience before I would cheat on my spouse, for example, right? I can't just do that tomorrow. That's a massive infidelity towards somebody that I love very deeply. So if you're doing that, then it speaks to the other scarring of, you know, but no, that has nothing to do because we compartmentalize. And the same is thought of in terms of, you know, whether I'm a good citizen while I sleep around. Well, that has nothing to do with that, right? None of those things. There's no connectedness to that. So in that way, sexuality is no big deal. It's whatever I choose to do to try to pursue my own happiness and fulfillment. Now, in other ways, and this is probably what you're more familiar with what's on the news all the time, other ways, sex is a really big deal. Way bigger than Christians would make it out to be. Our current culture still places unrelenting focus, for example, sexualizing almost every sphere of life. Entertainment, advertising, pornography, media, music. As much as any time in human history, sexuality is in every pore of everything, right? Relentless focus on it. We've come to expect more and more out of our sexual relationships in terms of personal fulfillment. Sex is often seen as indispensable to human happiness, right? I've seen this in so many stories, or so many, like TV shows, for example, where the couple's like, Like a couple of friends are talking. It's like, yeah, I haven't had sex in 8 months. I'm like, oh man, you must be miserable, right? It's like, that is, what? Yeah, that's not, you know, whether you're a happy, well-adjusted, content person is not tied to frequency of sexuality. So that's like saying, oh man, I hadn't had a slice of pie in 8 months. It's like, wow, you're miserable, right? Because pie is what life is about, right? And it's the same exact kind of thing, right? And so now, how did that happen? Well, it happened by God, at least mainly in our culture, God being jettisoned as the center of having a meaningful existence. And then what do you put in that place? In other words, what grounds meaningful existence? And this happened, philosophically speaking, in the 18th and 19th century, when you had transcendentalism and romanticism and all these worldviews that were replacing God as kind of, well, what does the good life look like? Existentialism, right? It looks like joie de vivre, that's an existentialist, right? It looks like getting out in nature and experiencing the basics of life, transcendentalism. Well, it means loving well and having art and music and all that, romanticism, right? But none of those won the day. You know what won the day? Good life is love. It's personal fulfillment in loving and being loved. And we understand, because we understand how God desires, why love won the day. But now that love, instead of directed as a relationship with God, is directed at this person, like this soulmate person. And no human being can handle that pressure, right? Or live up to it. And so we expect more and more out of those relationships. And of course, they can't deliver on grounding a meaningful existence. Now, none of this is happening consciously, okay? So it's not like people are walking around saying, I need to get married because I don't have a meaningful existence. You know, it's not that. But that's the way they are being programmed to feel by the stories, right? Okay. Sexual desires and preferences are increasingly being used to explain identity. This is another one that's just like, I mean, the only thing I can relate to this is AA meetings, you know, where you have to stand up and say, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. In other words, I've had to tie this particular sin to who I am. Now, but that is motivated by accountability, right? Not about identity. So I don't fault that at all. It's saying I'm not going to run away or mask what I'm struggling with anymore. But imagine the point of that was to say, that's at most core, that's who you are. An alcoholic, yeah. And that's exactly what we've done with gender identity and sexual preference. That this is most fundamentally who I am. This is why we're so incredibly, incredibly stupid right now with what we're doing to children. Where we would say, as a five-year-old, if you happen to start liking pink instead of blue, well, maybe we'll start putting you on a track to self-actualize as female. That's happening. It's like, you're a five-year-old. You don't even have any of the gender dynamics going on in your bodies yet. And yet you're taking these superficiality preferences and assigning paths. That's just ludicrous. Well, why would we do that? Because we've decided that mental gender awareness or your mental gender understanding of self and your sexual preference are some of the most central identifiers to identity, to who you are. They aren't just what you'd like to do, right? Well, that's incredibly unique. We've never defined ourselves that holistically by our desires. We've never said, I'm a chocolate cake guy. That's my whole life, right? I that's my favorite food, and I live for chocolate cake. And if we saw somebody do that, we'd be like, man, you're massively disordered. Your life is way more than just eating cake as often as possible, right? That's not good. That's way too much emphasis to be putting on that one preference. Okay, so the Bible doesn't do that. The Bible sees whatever sexual desires we have, whatever sexual sins, those are an amalgam of God's designed us to be drawn to other people and our sin nature, right? In other words, our sin nature always corrupts sexuality. It's just, it's going to corrupt it differently for different people. So don't define yourself by your type of corruption.
But hasn't this even gone further to, like, isn't there an asexual gender identity now? And
yeah. Like, yeah, but you know, the asexual thing that's happening now and some of that, I actually believe that's more of a political move. So we'll get to gender dysphoria later in the course, but actually, a psychological state where, you know, you're physically male and feel female, right? That's a long-term kind of, you know, it's pretty rare percentage-wise, but it's a long-term problem that's been around for a long, long time. This thing is very new. In other words, so I think it's more political as we seek to say genders are a means of oppressing people, and so it's more politically evolved and therefore more approved by the culture to have some sort of hip version of even casting it completely off, right? And culture is being asked to do that with bathrooms, with toy aisles, right, with all kinds of things. It's just saying, let's just take the gender labels completely off of that and let people do what they want to do. And so it doesn't surprise me that somebody who's really listening to the culture to figure out what's right and what's wrong would say, I don't know if I even have a gender. And for other people to go, well, that's even more evolved than the last person, right? Or I guess the term would be woke today, right? Not evolved, but anyway, that's stupid. That's the joke for the young people. You're even more woke than the last person. But anyway, I think that's more that related. I don't think it's actually that. And I think it's because of how incredibly confused this has made what male and female is. I mean, that whole discussion now is almost regulated to oppressive. We can't even talk about female or male norms. And so...
I get confused past the male and female thing.
Yeah, yeah. So there are lots of identities springing up. But again, that's a very new thing. So I don't think it's an actual kind of psychological state. I think it's more a reflection of the politics that's happening. Okay, what else? Sexual relationships have become the necessary context to truly love and be loved, while God and neighbor are optional. This is very important. In other words, a person is made to feel unwhole if they're the 40-year-old virgin, right? But not if they don't love their neighbor or they're not religious. Then they're not made to feel unwhole. But if they have a great romantic relationship, but they're not that great they ignore their neighbor and they're not religious, they're great, right? You see how it's become too big of a deal. It's like, obviously, the way we treat our neighbor and our understanding of God is far more important than whether we have a romantic partner. But not in our story, right? Not in our culture's story today. Okay. So why would Christians embrace some or all of this story is kind of where we're going to close today, okay? Why is this happening almost every time you get on the internet? You'll find some young Christian musician or leader or whatever that's adopting some aspect of this. Well, I mean, there's some obvious reasons, you know, social pressure and all those other things. But when you actually peel it back and you start to read the stories of Christians that have left kind of a biblical view of sexuality and embraced the culture's view in different ways, these are the main reasons, okay? So the first one's kind of obvious, their own sin, okay? So a lot of them leave because God's vision of sexuality makes them feel ashamed or broken about what they want for their own sexuality, right? And so if another narrative comes along and it justifies what they seem to naturally desire as good and healthy, then that's fine, right? Now that's personal. When my personal desires don't line up with, I don't desire marriage, I don't desire what God has designed for sexuality, I don't want that. I don't want to be a dad or a mom or whatever. I want something very different. And so sometimes it's personal sin like that. Sometimes it's the sin of I care way more about what other people think about me than what God says. Right? And that's again idolatry. That's caring more about your reputation before men than before God. So that's kind of the obvious one. But that's, believe it or not, that's not as big. I don't see this as often. You do see this. Not only if you're a Christian who identifies as gay, is it a hard world to live in, right? It's hard to, because churches have not figured out holistically how to help you, I don't think, not many of them, and how to love you well and all these other things. But also, you can kind of feel like, well, the way I naturally want to be is not a path, and our culture is constantly screaming at you that you're being mistreated because of those conflicted feelings. So it's a hard place to be. But more than often than not, the last three reasons are why I see Christians jumping ship. So two is familiarity. In other words, they know this narrative. Whether they could put these 10 points up there, they know this narrative so well, and they know the Bible so little. And yet, they're Christians, right? Last survey I saw of Christians, I think it was 20% or less of Christian adults had even read the whole Bible, much less know the Bible well, right? It was less than 20% that even read the whole thing. So, and these are evangelical Christians. So biblical literacy is very high, and yet how many narratives that have this cultural view of sexuality are we consuming on a daily basis through social media, through movies, through, I mean, way more than we ever did. You know, if you lived 100 years ago, you know, it'd take you 6 weeks to consume a story like that because it'd be in a book, right? Right? You wouldn't be able to binge watch, you know, 19 hours of the whole life of one of these characters and their whole sexual relationship in one Saturday. And so we're consuming so rapidly the stories of the culture, and we're just so familiar with this that our gut reactions to the biblical narrative on sex, because it's so foreign to what we're listening to all the time, is just like, that can't be right. It can't be right. And we think that's our conscience. But it's the culture. It's programmed us through thousands and thousands of these stories. Okay, the next one is really big. Okay, and if you don't know this one, this is a big problem for Protestant. I call it pervasive interpretive pluralism. I know that's a big frame. But what it means is, pervasive means just broad sweeping. Interpretive is talking about reading the Bible and figuring out what this means. And then pluralism means figuring out that there's a lot of ways to see it, okay? So think about how many issues that as Protestant Christians we've grown up to not really understand what the Bible teaches, but just say, well, there's a lot of points of view about that. And it's a kind of a cop-out, right? So what do you guys think about sovereignty and free will? What do you guys think about baptism, whether it should be done for infants or... And now you could be dogmatic, right? There's still tons of dogmatic Christians. It's like, well, it's only baptism by immersion for believers. Why? Chapter and verse. I don't know. Because that's the way I was raised, is the answer to that question. And so we're so used to, on almost any issue that comes up, Christians being able to say, well, I see it this way and I see it that way. So when an issue comes up like this, like, well, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? If you're somebody who is so familiar with this story and your gut reaction is, I don't like that the Bible is oppressing gay people, right? I feel like that's wrong. All it takes is one respectable Christian scholar to say, I think they're reading it wrong. Whew, I'm off the hook. There's another way to read that. And it doesn't matter. Nobody's a Berean anymore, in other words, right? It doesn't matter how ludicrous their you know, what's called hermeneutics are, how ludicrous their justification for why every passage condemns homosexuality. Oh, well, these were not affirming consensual gay relationships. These were something else. And you know, it doesn't matter how ludicrous that is. It just means there's a consenting Christian view, so now I can pick what I want. This is really a problem among Christians, especially in moral ethics. Because the second somebody comes forward and says, I'm an evangelical and I think we've been misreading this, we say, well, isn't that what we always do? We always have 50 views on things, and so I'll just pick which one I like. Instead of saying, well, then I have to be a Berean and I have to go figure out who's right and who's treating the scripture as authority instead of, you know, telling people what they want to hear, which is what the church is always at risk from. Okay, so that's pervasive interpretive pluralism. And then the last one is the most powerful. And the truth is that I'd say the majority of people that you know that have changed their position on biblical sexuality, it's because of personal stories of other people that they love, that they care about. And here's the reality. When you hear the personal story of somebody who's gay and has struggled with it their whole life, or somebody who's addicted to pornography and cannot shake it and is crushed in their conscience about it, and it's somebody that you love, there's immense pressure on you to affirm that person in order to save them the pain, to help them, right? And really, we don't know how to love people very well when we disagree with them. We just don't. We don't know how to say, I completely disagree with that. I think it's horrible for you, but it doesn't change the way I feel about you at all, or the fact that I'm always here for you, but I can't possibly go with you with that, because I think it will destroy you. It will not be a way of happiness. We just don't know how to do that anymore. And so when we hear these stories, and the other thing is it tears down the Christian stereotypes of what people like, what people in those categories are like, and it gives a real narrative. And the real narratives, I talked about this, your immoral behavior makes great sense inside your story. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. In other words, I'm not waking up in the morning and saying, what evil could I do today, right? This, my story plays out, and I feel like this is the best thing to do, even though it's sin. And that's exactly how the story of a gay person would say. I never felt like I was attracted to the opposite sex. I always had friends that were of the opposite gender, and I was always attracted. It's been this way since as long as I can remember. I resisted it forever. It created hatred, self-hatred in me, depression in me. I felt like other people abused me, and I was bullied because of it. And finally, I realized, well, this is how God made me, and I found joy and happiness in a relationship, and I realized, man, this is actually beautiful, and why would God have anything against this? And inside that story, you're like, well, you're not a person who's willfully choosing to be gay, right? And that's what I've thought people were doing, or you're a person that wrestled with this, and these personal stories shift people, right? They shift people, and then they go back to the Bible and say, can somebody save me? And guess what's waiting for them? Pervasive interpretive pluralism. Right? They can find somebody who's written on all the texts that I believe condemn this, who's let him off the hook, and they go, I'm going to go with this guy, because then I can love my child or my friend in the way that I feel like God would want me to. Does this make sense? Okay, so this is what's happening, and these four things are working in concert together, right? We all are corrupt sexually. Every one of us has idolatry in our heart. Every one of us experiences that in corrupting our sexual lives. Every one of us is very familiar with this story. Doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter how much or little you watch television, you're very familiar with this cultural story, and these points have kind of shown you that. Every one of us grew up where we've experienced pervasive interpretive pluralism, right? And there's times where I'm tempted to just pick the view that I like instead of being a Berean and saying, what does the scripture say? And then all of us probably at this point have experienced personal stories of people, whether maybe it's through a 60 Minutes interview with somebody who's transgender, and you're like, man, I never heard it said like that. You know, inside that narrative, what they're going through makes sense to me, right? So we've all experienced that. And those four are working in concert to move people little by little to reject a Christian story of sexuality. All right, so next week we'll start on the story, the biblical story of sexuality, okay? So that's what we'll do next week. Father, thank you for a chance to think about these things together. I know it's a time where what's happening in our culture is deeply grieving. Terms of people just giving themselves over more and more to their own desires, and even saying, in the fullest sense, that's who I am, is those desires. And so, God, I just pray that you would make this church a church that that loves and joyfully submits to your design for sexuality, but also increasingly, God, may we be a place that is a place of healing and love for the sexually broken, those that have been deeply harmed or wounded by their own decisions or the decisions of others in sexual sin, and then those that are wrestling with feelings that aren't consistent with desires that would be met by marriage. God, help us to become a place where we can love those people, counsel them, help them, understand what they should do with those feelings. And so we thank you for a chance to study together, and it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.